I think I'm having an art attack.
Welcome to another episode of Art Attack with your host, Lizzie Dastin, and myself, Justin Bua. So today, Lizzie, we're going to be talking about something that's a little bit more in your court, the esoteric, pretentious, contemporary garbage. I'm just kidding. The fine art, I'm kidding, but am I really kidding? I'm not really kidding, but I'm kidding because, like, why don't you walk us through who this artist is and give us a little backdrop and dress it up a little before I tear it down? Can you?
Well, when I suggested this artist, I didn't think that he was going to be labeled and classified as my court, but as you say it, I completely understand why. And I'm very excited to go through some of the projects that he enacted, because I think that you, if you don't know about them already, are just going to lambast them. And I'm excited for that moment for all of us. So we are talking about a French conceptual artist, Yves Klein, mm-hmm. who came from art France. Parents. Yeah, yeah.
From Nice, which is nice. He came
right?
from Nice.
He was born in Nice. And, oh, nice. That's funny. And he had an artistic childhood because mm-hmm. his mother was a painter in the avant-garde group Art Informel. And his dad was a more traditional painter. He worked in the post-impressionist style. And so Klein was always immersed in that artistic atmosphere. And I think that was the origins of his own creative interest. And he would go on to really push the extremes of the avant-garde, and in Europe too. We've talked about how the epicenter of the art world really shifts from Europe, specifically France, to the United States after World War II. And so we've talked a bunch about conceptual thinkers in the United States at that time, but haven't really looked at what was happening concurrently in Europe. So I thought that this would be a nice conversational piece to really describe some of the similar themes that are happening abroad. And Klein is a great example because he was very, very conceptual, highly so, and almost aligned with somebody like Robert Rauschenberg. He embraced this Zen concept of the void.
The void, Lizzie, because nothing was really there. Is that correct? No, I want you ever see my take. If anybody has the opportunity to go Google Rauschenberg, Justin Bua, you could see my take on Rauschenberg. I did a really cool breakdown of him. I've actually never gotten more hate mail than or hate text or hate DMs and Instagram. I don't even know how people get so much shame on you hate to me these days, but I think it's through that platform or that medium. Anyway, yeah, so I know his work, obviously. He's definitely in the pantheon of contemporary artists. I do know that also, you know, which is interesting with contemporary artists, sometimes you find that they don't come from a traditional background. And oftentimes when you do see these artists that come from traditional backgrounds, like you said, his father was a post-impressionistic painter and he was mostly figurative, which is interesting. So I would probably hedge my bets that he had some kind of classical training. I know that as, you know, his parents loved his work and I, once again, I'm caught in the lane of, I don't get it. And I know, you know, a lot of people are like me and they don't get it. And then a lot of people kind of look at it and they go, oh my God, that's so incredible. But I also know that he was responsible for more than just, being a very successful breakthrough contemporary painter, because I know that he influenced a lot of directors, interior designers. I hear that all the time, that he was a really big influence. And you can Google that and see inspired music videos and inspired. I could see why too, because of his palette and his colors.
Absolutely. And he's kind of in that milieu of a John Cage or a Merce Cunningham, again, a Robert Rauschenberg. And so I don't know if there was an explicit cross-pollination of their ideas, but it makes sense to me too that he might inspire other art forms because of how interdisciplinary and conceptual his art was, and also very physical. He was a fourth degree black belt in judo.
Yeah, I read that. That's crazy. That's absolutely wild. Like he actually went to
Japan
and studied and got his black belt. And that's a pretty physical thing. But don't forget who else is a black belt in judo is Putin.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. He's a black belt in judo, as are many fighters that I follow. But that is interesting, right? Because at one point, you know, you think of these people who have an incredible amount of fame in this world, and then you see them go into another realm so deeply, right? He was one of those guys where when he was vested, he was completely all in. Like he wasn't even going to paint anymore. And then he went all into judo, and then he just got back into painting. It's so weird. It's so unusual.
Yeah, very passionate man, very immersed in whatever form of art was inspiring him at that moment. And I think visually, he's best known for his monochrome paintings. Mm. And he painted really with three colors. So he would paint all pink paintings, all gold paintings, and then his most recognizable color is the ultramarine blue. And for him, those colors, they represented a holy trinity. He saw gold as the Father and blue as the Son, and then pink as the Holy Spirit. And he was raised Catholic, and spirituality and that investment in his spiritual center always was a driving force in Klein's work. And so we see that in the color palette. And the blue is interesting because blue historically has a really significant relationship to religious paintings. At the time of the Renaissance, blue was made using this lapis lazuli stone that was mostly found in mountainous areas of Afghanistan. And the stones were ground down, and then the pigment was just a part of that stone. And then it was so rare and so expensive that artists would use it just to illustrate the most holy of their paintings, of their work. And often you'll see lapis indicate the outfit of a saint, or Mary Magdalene's robes would be polychromed with this lapis. And then blue eventually was, it was turned into a synthetic color. And so Yves Klein, he is inserting himself within this really rich tradition of seeing blue as a holy indicator. And he worked with a chemist to create this ultramarine that was so vivacious that it wouldn't fade. Often the intensity of colors, they fade over time. And he didn't want that. So he created this special blue, and then he patented it. And it's known as IKB, International Klein Blue. And so that shows a business acumen, too, that he would be interested in creating something that was his own and that would signal himself as different from any other artist who would implore. And just using that curiosity of monochrome color, because a lot of artists at the time were exploring that concept, Rauschenberg being my chief example, but Rauschenberg never patented his own pigment. And so that was something that Klein did that's really separated his practice from those working contemporaneously.
Where would you get that color now?
I don't know. I'm sure.
IK2? Is that what it
IKB,
is?
International IKB. International
Klein
Blue.
Huh. And that's an oil paint and not an acrylic, right? Obviously.
I would suspect it's oil.
That's so
and
weird.
It's very tactile. If you look at a Klein painting, there aren't that many because he died very young. He died when he was only 34. So he was pretty prolific during the years that he was working, but those years were pretty finite. And if you see a work of his in person, it really does feel powdery and rich and lush. And it isn't just this smooth enamel surface. It feels like it is visceral. And it's a really exciting experience to look at a Klein in person.
I wonder if he got sick from the paint. Because, you know, like when my grandfather gave me a color, which was called, you know, it was like a very old oil paint tube. He gave me a bunch of them. And some of them back then were a lot more toxic. And it was called phthalocyan blue. So he gave me that. And I was doing a couple of paintings. I painted Arsenio Hall and I painted Alfred Hitchcock in that color. And I used to use my fingers to kind of rub it in. And eventually I wound up getting something that was called cholinergic urticaria, which was an incredible acute heat reaction to the paints. And when I brought it in to my teacher, it was just completely random. My painting, I had my tubes with me, and he goes, "Hey, I don't, where'd you get that tube?" He's like, "That's really old." And I was like, yeah, my grandfather gave it to me, you know. My grandfather was like in his late 80s at the time. And he said, "Oh, I wouldn't use that. That has cyanide in it." And then he showed me the back of it. And sure enough, it had cyanide because paints back then, you know, and this is like, I mean, maybe from the 60s or 70s that he gave me this tube, were you like, you know, cyanide was used as some kind of emulsifier. I don't know in what capacity it was used, but it was used. And so I had literal cyanide poisoning. So I'm thinking right now, I know nothing, but this is a guy who died very young of cancer in a time when, you know, it was not very prevalent, right? So
I think it was a heart attack, a series of heart attacks.
Yes, but right. That's right. That's right. But still, like, what would cause that to such a young, because I saw videos of him and pictures of him and he looked like he was in good shape and he had good health. But okay. Point being is that it is very toxic to work with some of those colors, especially the early colors and sometimes the blues. And like you said, the colors that came from, you know, these certain places, and we just don't know what was in them. So just a warning. What was the other one? It was Schiff Green. Shields Green. You know, Shields Green is another one. So Shields Green was a really, really big color in the early 1900s. And they were using it even before that. And they were using it for drapery and for gowns. And it was literally killing people. And they didn't know that. And this is really early on. And they were saying that Napoleon, there's a lot of theories that Napoleon died from Shields Green because he had his entire room decorated and painted in that Shields Green. And so when women put it on as dresses, they died. They all got poisoned from it. So historically, yes, terrifying, right? So like, but they've done that forever. I mean, they used it for candies and stuff like that. People were ingesting these poisons historically. That's a whole other thing. We should do an episode called Art and the Color and the Poisonous Colors of Art.
Or how Art that kills.
Art that kills, yeah. Or colors that kill.
Well, hopefully CTK. This IKB doesn't kill, because I do think that people can acquire it today, but
I don't understand how that's proprietary. Like, he's got IP on a color. Ultramarine, you stated that he uses a lot of ultramarine. Ultramarine's a warm blue, right? It's a red blue, essentially. That's what French ultramarine goes back to is as opposed to a Prussian or a phthalo or a really, really light, cold, freezing cold cyan. So it has a different kind of temperature to it. But I wonder what his color is. And I was looking, you know, and in fairness, when I look at his work, I'm not moved by it. I'm not impressed by it, but it is like a swatch of blue. So I don't really understand how you can see it through a screen and appreciate it. I think that is a kind of experience you really have to be present for. You have to be in front of it. You have to be immersed in it. Yeah, because otherwise you're like, okay, cool. I'm looking at a blue thing and he sold this for how many millions of dollars? Like, this is ridiculous.
Right. And moving on to his more conceptual work, it is nearly impossible to see even on a screen. So I think that he aligns with the zeitgeist of the time in that much of his work doesn't have a corresponding object. And so you only really read about it. So it is a concept alone. And then the work that does have a physicality to it, like his canvases, the IKB canvases, and he painted various sculptures in the same blue, they need to be appreciated in person to really grasp the richness of their texture, as you mentioned. And there's one exhibition that he mounted with his paintings. I believe there were 11 or 12 of them, completely identical in size and in this monochrome color. And he priced them each differently. Mm. And so that, I think, is a little tongue-in-cheek. And with a project like that, there can always be two ways of interpreting it. One as making fun of a viewer, and the other kind of leaning into a joke that the viewer shares and really dismantling expectations of the art world. And that's what I think he was doing. But of course, it's completely valid to see it as a mockery of art lovers and art consumers. But that was one project that he did. And another, a really infamous gallery show, he rented out this big space in France. I believe this one was right outside of Paris. And 2,500 people, if not more, lined up to see the show. And they were met with an entirely empty gallery. And Klein said that the work that he was exhibiting was invisible work. Mm. And some people, they walked in, they laughed, and then they left. And others apparently stayed for hours just ruminating on the experience. Mm. And Klein, he made the specialty cocktail and he offered it to people in line for the show. And this cocktail was formulated with some kind of chemical that made the viewers pee International Klein Blue for a week.
Wait, is it?
And so they became
stop
part
that.
Of the...
how is that possible? What could they?
I don't know.
So he gave them something. It's like eating beets, and then you pee red, and then it's like some version of that, like some kind of like cyan phytochemical.
Yeah.
Right, like some it would be like, but I don't even know how that's possible. Anyway, that's
I don't either. But how hilarious! And so there's
I mean
no
hilarious,
art.
But it sounds scary too. It sounds crazy.
Well, today you'd need consent. Is it okay if I give you this cocktail that is going to impact your body chemistry? But I guess in the late 50s, that wasn't really a concern.
Anything
but what I yeah, I just find it so. So interesting and such an engaging concept that he removed art from the actual experience of art viewing, and yet he left this artistically inspired art impression on his viewers that they would only experience alone in their bathroom. There was no IKB on the walls. It was just in your commode.
So, Lizzie, let me ask you a personal question. A of all, do you really like his work? And B of all, do you think that he was as important as a Rauschenberg, as a Warhol, as a Jackson Pollock, as a Rothko? Where in all of those garbage artists that in all of those contemporary artists that I name, where would you list his importance? Is he on the lower spectrum of influential, or is he really one of the founding fathers? Is his face going to be on the Mount Rushmore of contemporary art work?
So I'd like to address your first question first. And do I like his work? I think what makes these conversations so fun is that our lenses are really different. We have different schema. And for me, my schema is this person significant to note? Did this person influence others? Was this person digesting the cultural artistic context that he or she was immersed in? And did this person use that to say something of value? So for me, if I only taught artists that I like, it would be a very different type of class. So personally or professionally? Professionally, yes, I think he's incredibly significant. Mm-hmm. Personally, I love the monochromes. Some of the performances, I think, of course, have intellectual value, but I find them a tiny bit gimmicky. And we haven't even got, well, a tiny bit is even equivocating. I find them gimmicky, but at the time in the late 50s, nobody was doing something this disruptive in art. And so for him, it wasn't a gimmick. It really was a sincere exploration of transcendentalism in art.
Well, that's why would you say that though? Because I mean, Duchamp was doing disruptive art and, you know, Rothko. I mean, there was a lot of artists doing disruptive work.
Well, absolutely. But Rothko, he never made invisible work.
Right, and yeah, that's crazy.
Everything was object-based. It was a pre-made object. So sure. Certainly that dismantled everything that was expected in the 19-teens. But at this point, I don't know really any other visual artist who with such an earnest spirit was using the invisible as something that has monetary value.
And also poisoning people without their consent. Right. Which
and
is
possibly really, himself.
Yeah, well, clearly, I mean, he died of a heart attack at, you know, 34. So, okay, so that's fair. And because of that, and you keep going back, is it the monochrome? Is it the invisibility? Is it his complete, almost feels like he's making fun, right? When you get to that level, like, because recently there was something that I spoke about on my Instagram page, and I say recently, a couple months ago, where I talked about this guy who sold an invisible statue. And I thought that was the first I've ever heard of that. I didn't realize that Klein was beat him to the, you know, gimmick. But there was a huge thing where a collector bought an invisible statue and it was all over the news. And I comment on it. And it was like, it's hilarious, right? Because if people are willing to go that far, then really there's no rules to anything. But you telling me that he was the first, and he probably did a lot of stuff like that just to kind of, you know, shake the cage that we all live in.
I think to shake the cage, but also really to see the sky as the world's greatest painting. I think that's another reason why he was so interested in blue, and to see the world and these moments of pause as the real art. From everything I've read about Klein, I don't think that from his perspective, it was a gimmicky gotcha moment. I don't think there was much humor in his art, and I could be completely wrong, but I think that he philosophically was really just trying to express visually this transcendental experience that he had in life and this Zen alignment with body and space and atmosphere. And I think that is what he was trying to accomplish, that I don't know of anybody working before around the same time or after was doing. Certainly John Cage, which is why I mentioned him earlier, he also embraced this concept of the void in his famous symphony, the 4 minutes and 33 seconds of silence. And interestingly, Klein also incorporated musicality in some of his work. He did, or before I explain that, I just wanted to note that in this exhibition where gallery visitors were poisoned with this blue cocktail, the Nobel Prize winning poet and philosopher, Albert Camus, he visited, he was one of those guests, and he signed the guest book and he signed it with the void, full powers. Wow. So some people really embraced it, and not all. So maybe I'd be the one crying, looking at nothing, and you'd be the one laughing. And
that's even how people received him then. Like you said, some people were like, you know, some people laughed, some people pretended to enjoy it. And then other people probably were like, this motherfucker, like, what an asshole, right? Because he just wasted my time.
Right.
You know, so, but I get all of that. You know, I don't, you know, once again, I'm really more than anything curious to see where kind of his late teens, early 20s work was and what led him to that, besides the fact that his mom, who was an avant-garde contemporary painter, was her encouraging him. Besides that, like, what, where was the departure? You know, that's his holy curiosity. And I see it with a lot of the conceptual artists that I like, you know, Picasso being one of them. And you could see the real delineation of blue period, rose period, cubism, you know, his amazing Greek plates etchings that he did. So you could see all of that. But I like to see the genesis.
Yeah, I would too. And I think Picasso is an interesting parallel to Klein, because Picasso is such a master of line, and Klein hated lines. He said that he saw them as restrictive, almost like bars in prisons. And so he wanted to paint and to create expansiveness. And maybe that's what initially inspired him to embrace this idea of the invisible. And one thing that he did, which I wonder if even he thought this was a little shticky, is that he would privately sell his invisible paintings to buyers, and he would meet them on the banks of the Seine, and they would show up with gold leaf. And that's how he wanted his payment. And he would show up and he would create a COA, a certificate of authenticity, and he would give the certificate, he would receive the gold, and then he would light the certificate on fire. And so now the buyer had no certificate, and then he would throw the gold leaf that they had given him into the Seine. And so now there's no
proof. Exchange.
Yeah, no exchange at all. There was never a painting to begin with, but there was a COA, or maybe there was, maybe I just can't see it because I can't see what's invisible, but the painting was invisible. The COA was real. The gold was real, but then he destroyed what was existent.
You sound like more of like a prankster than a painter. And, you know, also Delacroix felt the same way, though, not to compare him to Delacroix, but Delacroix hated line. I mean, that's why he hated Ang, Jean-Dominique Ang. And Delacroix was it was all value, value, color, color, shape, shape, form, form. And felt the same thing. I don't know if he ever said that line was, you know, was like prison bars, but I know that he was definitely counter line. And, you know, the great masters like Leyendecker and Ilya Repin, and some of the more stylistic Alfonso Mucha, those are the real interesting ones that are able to use line and value together and create a symphony of both of them intersecting, as opposed to the Angs of the world, who obviously Ang was a painter, but you could see that line was much more involved in his in the process of his painting, as are, you know, artists obviously like Charles Dana Gibson and Erte, and those were just straight Bernie Wrightson. These are straight Heinrich Kley, straight line masters. I personally see value in both, and I look at an artist like Mucha and Leyendecker and Cornwell, Dean Cornwell, and those are the people who have been able to kind of merge those two worlds together. But to be so vehemently opposed to line is just hilarious to me.
Yeah, to me too. Just as an art enthusiast and a curious analyzer, I don't really understand that. But for him, it was just incredibly restrictive. And you, just to get back to your question as to whether I personally like him. So I think professionally, yes, has tremendous value. Personally, I do not love this next performance that he did, and a series called Anthropometrie. And for this one, so normally with his canvas work, he would use rollers rather than brushes because he likes the all-over aesthetic that was engendered from a roller brush rather than something a little bit smaller. But for Anthropometrie, he wanted to get rid of brushes altogether. And he has this quote, which You'll understand why I don't love this piece when I share the quote. He said he no longer dirtied himself with color, not even the tips of his fingers. Hmm. And he used nude female models as the brushes. So nude female models, they would dip themselves in IKB and then drag each other across canvases. And so the women became the object, the brush, literalized, and their body, the imprintation of their nude form, was the subject. And
it's funny because everything you're saying is stuff that's happening now in the art world. And I did another piece on that where they had a woman strung upside down and they use her hair as the brush, and there's a guy like pushing her and she's creating art from the dripping of her. She's a nude woman who's basically hogtied and she's dripping art from her hair. But now I'm thinking that all of these crazy fucked up modern art pieces, for conceptual art pieces, they're really conceptual. They're not necessarily contemporary or modern, but they are performative modern, pieces that are being used today. And they seem like they just lifted it from him.
Yeah. I forgot about that video that you did. And yes, of course, when you describe it, I remember it. And so much of contemporary performance could be seen as derivative of Klein. Mm-hmm. And for his Anthropomasqui performances, there was one instance, at least, when he hired a full orchestra. And for 20 minutes, the orchestra played one single note. And then that was followed by 20 minutes of silence. So he's thinking about the entire performance as this immersive event. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the artists that we've talked about thought similarly, but he was among the first. And especially considering this is happening in Europe post-World War II, I think that is notable because much of the innovative avant-garde work that at least we've discussed together has been in the United States. So mm-hmm. he was a trailblazer. And I don't think that at the time he would have thought of the choice to use a woman or to equate the woman with an object as a patriarchal choice. I think that was just how women's bodies were seen in the 50s. But it's important to look back on those choices and to be critical of them.
Yeah.
Which I am.
Which so that's we know you are, for sure. Yeah. Okay, so I think we've covered him. I think I think what he said, basically, he's trailblazed a lot of garbage, which is out today. And everybody is so freaking derivative, it's ridiculous. Because I never even realized that, people are just stealing from him. It's so weird. Like, you see these things that I never saw an invisible statue and I never saw a woman hung upside down. And I'm not saying that's art at all. In fact, if you see my posts, I say that's counter art. That is absolutely not art whatsoever. But yet, here's a guy who was doing this, 70 years ago, almost. That's crazy.
Yeah, it really is. Well,
okay, so what else, Lizzie? What other stuff did he start to do that where he really messed up art, the whole art scene? He's really responsible for just all of this derivative conceptual art we're seeing today.
Well, something else that has been quoted and parodied and utilized by multiple subsequent artists, specifically in the realm of photography, he did this one work. It was close to the time of his death, so a later work in his oeuvre, and it's called Leap into the Void. And looking at it, it looks as though Klein is on the second story of some building, and he's just swan diving into the street, and there's nothing to catch him. And at the time, people were very shocked by this. And he actually printed out one day's worth of fake newspapers and he put them all over the city. So a lot of people saw this image. He was a great marketer. Say what you want to about Klein. He did have that business sensibility. And that was about this transcendence of being able to levitate. He always said that he could levitate. And this was the photographic proof that he could. And he said that this happened once before, but nobody was there to take a picture. And so this was this proof, this irrevocable proof that he could fly. Is he falling? Is he flying? And what I think this was influential to was photography, that so much of photography is physically manipulated. And this photo by Klein is no exception. There's another photo that I show in my classes where you can see on the ground, there are multiple people holding out this tarp ready to catch him. So he took two photos, one of the street empty, and then another of him swan diving off of the building, which he actually did, but you don't see that he was caught. And then essentially he just stitched the negatives together and then printed it as a cohesive image when it was really a composite.
Okay, so he was also responsible for faking, like, flying and lying and dying.
Yeah, he is the original liar.
He's the original liar. He's the original, well, definitely many preceded that him. But he's the original, maybe bungee, no bungee cord jumper, free falling, descending artist. Okay, Lizzie. So from what I'm hearing, it's, you know, he really opens up from somebody who doesn't clearly know a lot about him and his contributions to the artistic culture. I think what he also did, you know, clearly was not take things too serious and have fun with things and really question, you know, the parameters of what art is. You know, is art that which we say it is? It's like Ansel Adams, the proof of existence of God. God is that which nothing greater can be conceived, right? So he starts kind of a formulaic, mathematical argument about the existence of God. And I think that in many ways, that's what his goal is. He's setting out to say that, like, this is art because I'm doing it, and, you know, I'm going to leave it up to you to experience it, and then you can, you know, be pissed at me or laugh at me or think I'm really brilliant. But he has the luxury to be able to do that, right? Because of the fact that in many ways he's alone, right? There's not a bunch of, like, now today you couldn't get away with that because no one cares. Everybody's doing it. Every university and college is producing kids who are doing that kind of stuff. And, you know, I had dabbled in a lot of that myself, right? Like, at when I went to Art Center, and Art Center was a very classical, you know, in quotes, school that was very traditional and very illustrative. But I think that, you know, we also did fine art classes and we had to play in that realm, but I don't think anybody was really playing in that realm. You know, very few people. He kind of had, you know, he had that whole lane on lock in many ways, right? Like, he could do that and he could get pressed. You do that now, no one cares. You know what I mean? 2024, you jump off a building and you buy a bunch of papers and people go, that's a scam, who cares? You know, at the best, there's a meme, maybe. And it circulates for one day on Instagram and then it's like, he's gone. But, like, in his time, he was, that made a lot of sense. I mean, you could get 2,500 people, you know, into a room. And today, doing that, forget about it. You're going to need a lot of money and a lot of posting, a lot of TikTok ads or whatever to get people there. And then when people got there, they wouldn't care.
Yeah. And I think people also sincerely questioned the veracity of his projects. Did he actually leap? Did he levitate? Did he fall? And we just don't see that image.
Right.
And that kind of naive curiosity and the willingness to go along with somebody's journey, I don't think that we have that in the same way. We're always wondering, well, what's the trickery in that?
Right, right.
And how did he or she actually make that happen? And of course, there's no invisible art. So I do think that he was incredibly disruptive. And I agree with what you say, that his work is humorous, but I also think that it was really deeply earnest. And
I'm not saying it wasn't earnest. I'm just saying, you know, that I think that he was also making fun of the world in which he was surviving off of.
Yeah. How could he not?
And participating in, because there's no way that you have an invisible show and you don't go home and you're like laughing hysterically, or you don't like, you're jumping off a building and when people are picking up the paper and you're like walking down the street anonymously and you're watching those people as a voyeur pick right. up a paper and look at you and you're like, oh my God, I can't believe they're believing that. That's amazing. Right. So there's that moment like where he's definitely making fun of, sure, other people, and yes, himself too, but more importantly, overall of the industry, of the art world. Yeah. And I think that's where maybe there's a lot of merit to what he was doing, is because he's really making fun of how bizarrely ridiculous this all is. And what, and also questioning what is art. And there you have it. Go get that color. I don't care. No, what's it called again? The color?
IKB.
IKB. Yeah. IKB. I'm going to go look up IKB, Lizzie. And share this episode and share the other episodes, and let's have the best day ever. I'm going to go jump off the building right now. I got to go. I'm going to do some stunt. I'm going to do some crazy shit.
Go paint something invisible.
Yeah, I'm inspired. Okay. Have the best day. Bye, guys.